Hello.
Hi.
Good morning. Can you hear? Pretty good? This thing is. There. Still hear good? Okay. Oh, it's good to see you all. Here we are. It's the month of May. The month of May is so sublime in Minneapolis. It's just so beautiful. I've been walking around the neighborhoods and by the lakes and all the flowering trees and bushes. It's just fantastic. Andrea gave a talk here last weekend, and she talked about one of her favorite phrases of Katagiri Roshi, and it's also one of mine. Let the flower of your life force bloom. And I think that nature is letting flower of its life force bloom, and it's especially intense because winter went on and on and on. It was just over a week ago, and now we have this. So May is a special, has special meaning for me this time of year. It's a time both sublime and has some sorrow and loss attached to it, and also some terror, which I'll tell you about. I'll tell you a story about that as we go. So some of you know that I really like poetry a lot, and I have been working, sort of living into a poem for several weeks now, and a friend of mine sent it to me after the women's retreat of 2012. And I put it away. I read it and I thought, that's nice. I put it away. But I took it out again in recent weeks and have been really living into it. So I'm going to share it with you. Poetry to me is, it's beauty. It's, I love it. It's also medicine. I see it as a kind of medicine, just like the Dharma is medicine. The Buddha is the great physician. So, I have a couple quotes from this book that I've been looking at called Saved by a Poem. And I'll read to you a couple little excerpts from that before we get into the poem. This is from Mary Oliver. Poetry is a life-cherishing force. For poems are not words after all, but fires for the cold, ropes let down to the lost. Something as necessary as bread in the pockets of the hungry. Yes, indeed. And here's Pablo Neruda. Poetry. And it was at that age, poetry arrived in search of me. I don't know where it came from winter or a river. I don't know how or when. No, they were not voices, they were not words nor silence. But from a street I was summoned, from the branches of night, abruptly from others, among violent fires, or returning alone. There I was, without a face, and it touched me. And some of you are probably familiar with that poem. A lot more to it. So I'm going to start by reading this poem to you. And I'm going to read it twice. And then I'm going to go through and talk about it. Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. so you know how desolate the landscape can be between regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you've been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So I'll read it another time. Sometimes we can't take it all in first. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. And it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you've been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. What you held in your hand, counted on, carefully saved, the future you planned, all this must go, she says. This is the Buddha's teaching. This is the first noble truth, that life contains suffering. It contains loss and sorrow, and that loss is part of life, change is constant, impermanence. So, I see the purpose of our practice is to wake up with everyone to kindness and compassion. Otherwise, what do we do it for? What is the purpose of this? We don't wake up simply for ourselves. but we do our practice of awareness, of being here with what is, so that we can offer comfort to others. So what she's saying, of course, is that to know kindness and compassion at the most intimate of levels, we have to be intimate with loss and sorrow. Have you ever experienced a sudden loss that changed your life overnight, changed your plans? Well, I did. I will tell you the story of May 6, 1965. I was 10 years old, and I lived in Fridley, Minnesota, and it was a very hot and humid day, May day, and I was playing in the neighborhood with my sisters, wearing just, you know, shorts, a t-shirt, barefoot, feeling free, feeling like everything was so solid and stable. And then the sky got very, very dark, and it began to hail into the streets. We were still playing outside, and the hail was big, like the size of you know, tennis balls or something, very big hail. And so we went into the house, and we heard there were tornado warnings. Our father wasn't home. It was my mother and my sisters. So we went into the basement, and this tornado, which is a historic tornado, you can hear all about it. You can go to the History Museum, actually. There's an exhibit, and you can go in and experience it. You should do it. It's pretty interesting. I was surprised when I found out that it was in the History Museum, and there's a basement there, and you can go in there, and the experience of the tornado coming when you're inside a basement is simulated, and it's quite realistic. I thought I was ready for it. I went in with my husband about, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years ago, and I said, oh yeah, that's going to be. The basement looked just like our basement. It had the same kind of couch and television set from the 60s and everything, the casement windows, and the sky turned green, and there were sound effects. And I found myself gripping my husband's hand pretty tightly, after all. So this, I think it was an F6 or F8 tornado. It's a very powerful tornado, ripped through our neighborhood and basically took out everyone's homes, including ours. And we were in the basement and experiencing this, and suddenly everything was gone, you know? There was a lot of noise. First there was a lot of noise, like a train, as they say, and then some crashing, smashing sounds. Then there was some silence, like just total silence. And that's pretty much all I remembered until it was over. And I looked up and saw the sky where the ceiling should be. And my sisters and I were, someone immediately came and pulled us out of what was left of our house in the basement. And then we walked through the streets to find a place where people were staying who'd been living in all these houses that were basically piles of kindling, is what they looked like from an aerial photograph later. So that was my experience. I think it was the birthplace, perhaps, of compassion and kindness at age 10. You know, and I think, you know, I wasn't aware so much. I was living moment to moment, you know, but, and I wasn't aware so much of how that affected my future. Of course, as a child and living in the moment, but I could see how it affected my parents, especially my mother. You know, all those things she gathered in the dreams around that place were suddenly gone. So that's my story that speaks to this. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. Passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. The story behind this is that Shihabnai, who had a Palestinian father and a Texan mother, American mother from Texas, that she did a lot of traveling in her life. And she was traveling on a bus in Guatemala in the 70s. And her experience at that moment is she's riding and riding, that she'll ride on forever, and people are eating their maize and chicken, staring out the window. And there's this sense that we often have that our experience is something solid, something reliable, and something routine, even in mundane. You know, we get fooled easily by our habitual ways of thinking. So that's what she's talking about. We create this predictable story that gives us stability, we think. You know? But reality flows. Reality flows and just goes from moment to moment, and sometimes reality contains very surprising things, shocking things. So there I was in 1965, thinking that I lived in the most boring place in the world, and that, you know, nothing ever happened, and the summer was going on for long, and everything was going to be secure, and suddenly it became all too interesting. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. The phrase is tender gravity of kindness. And the simple breath that kept him alive it's a very jarring juxtaposition with the Indian and the white poncho dead by the side of the road. This poem it collapses the boundaries between peaceful and violent and tender and horrifying. And so it wakes us up. It really wakes us up. And sometimes we are a little disturbed by that. But that's what a good poem will do. Tender gravity of kindness. The root of the word kindness is kin, which means, of course, family and those who are close to us. And gravity is the force that keeps us on the earth, right? This beautiful, fragile planet that we walk on that supports our life, and gravity is the force that allows us to be connected to others. So I love the phrase, tender gravity of kindness. In those relationships, we have the opportunity to manifest kindness. That's one of our very important purpose. So when we understand that the terrible thing that happened to our neighbor could happen to us, and the loss is sustained by those we see on the evening news, and we can feel some empathy and compassion that we were meant to experience, we were meant to feel through our long evolution, the evolution of our brain, the human being. Pretty good. Studies have shown that even really young kids, of 1.5 and 2 years old, can feel empathy for other children that are crying. And, you know, they develop that empathy because of their caregivers, the mirroring of kindness and empathy that they receive. But kindness and compassion isn't always sweet and naive. It can be really fierce and tough. Joan Halifax Roshi tells a story, the story about when she went blind as a child. And her parents brought in to care for her a woman who was descended from slaves. I believe they lived in the South. And she was a very tough woman. She was a very compassionate woman. And her care did not include encouraging self-pity in Joan, but rather strength. Strength. So she feels that was the roots of the work she does now with hospice, with dying people and with caregivers and with professionals in the hospice field. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow, speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrow, and you see the size of the cloth. This reminds me of the story of Kisa Gotami. Many of you know this story. She was a wealthy woman in the time of the Buddha, and her child died, and she went mad. She couldn't accept the fact that her child was dead, and she carried her child around asking people if they could help her, asking for help to heal her child. So finally an elderly neighbor in the village who knew the Buddha was in town brought her to the Buddha, and the Buddha said he would heal her child if she would go to all the houses in the village and bring back some, I guess it is, mustard seeds from any family that had not experienced any death. And so she did that. And of course, you can imagine, she couldn't find a single household that wasn't touched by this. So she came back to the Buddha. I think that must have been a sobering experience for her. Must have cut through her denial. So she regained her clarity of mind, and today we might say, in the language of brain science, that she returned to her baseline. Her baseline. Through seeing the universality of death and loss, that's through the kindness of the Buddha. And I might add, skillful means. So she then agreed to bury her child and asked to be admitted to the Sangha. She later became a leader of the women's Sangha, Kisa Gotami. She was able to see the size of the cloth, how vast it is, and then make that connection to all of the neighbors and rejoin the community. What I have to do as a chaplain when I have a night where I encounter a lot of suffering, as a hospice chaplain, I have to return to my baseline. Sometimes it can be pretty overwhelming to feel the suffering of others and to be aware of what's possible in that realm. So I have to use my practices, sitting, walking, being outdoors, sleep, and emotional support from friends that brings me back to my baseline, because compassion, it does touch us deeply. It has its effect. Jill Bolte Taylor in her book, Stroke of Insight. I know Tim has talked about that book, and I've read that recently, and I recommend it. It's a fascinating book, and there's a lot of good ideas in there for working with our conditioning, our minds. And she talks about losing her left hemisphere function, so her ability to create language and to calculate, plan. All of that, she said, went offline. She said, offline. And she was wholly in her right hemisphere, which is connected to oneness. And oneness, that oceanic interconnection. And she actually loved that feeling. She really wanted to stay there. There was a part of her that really was drawn to stay in that. There was another part of her that knew if she didn't work hard and work fast, she would completely lose her left hemispheric functioning, and that she really, really needed that. And I think poetry, when we feel a poem like this poem or other poems that we really love, we're feeling it, we're using our right hemisphere. It's not like Poetry 101, where we're dissecting it and we're, you know, counting the syllables and, you know, talking about the style and the. It's not that at all. This way of experiencing poetry. This is very right hemisphere. Anyway, one of the things she said was so important, and she worked for NAMI. She volunteered for NAMI, the National Association for Mentally Ill. And she talks about how what she learned is that one of the most important things about having a healthy brain is that it allows us to have shared experiences with others. So that's what Kitsuki Tomio was able to be restored to. A shared experience. And in the Mahayana Buddhism, we're always including everyone in our practice, in our experience, in our intention, in our vow. We don't leave anyone outside of the circle. You see how vast the clock is, you know, like the astronauts who saw the Earth from space and came back so changed by that. There's this upworthy piece going around on Facebook that it's a very nice piece about a group of astronauts who formed, former astronauts who formed an organization. And they talk about how much it changed their perception. Just they call it the overview effect, just the ability to see the planet, made a huge impression on it. Then it's only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out to the world to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you've been looking for. And then goes with you everywhere. But when we touch the depths of human suffering and loss, and of our own and other people, and we receive the kindness of others, I think this is about receiving the kindness of others. That's what happens when we experience a loss. Then we experience others' kindness, the kindness of strangers, the kindness of friends. The year that my father died in May as well, May 1st, 2 years ago. And during the time leading up to his passing, it was challenging. It was very challenging. And my friends in the Sangha showered me with kindness over a long period of time, what seemed like a very long period of time. And that kindness has touched me so much, so greatly. That's with me. It's with me. And I get this about how that becomes the most important motivation. That's what gets me to get out of bed in the morning and put on my clothes and sit on the cushion. That's a deeper motivation. Having received that level of kindness and seeing how important, how sustaining, how nourishing that is. So you can see how dealing with loss and sorrow works in the lives of people who are inspiring. I'm thinking about Katagiri Roshi, who lost his mother, I think at a young age. And Suzuki Roshi, whose first wife died very tragically, leaving their children motherless. And Thich Nhat Hanh, who lost friends and his country in the Vietnam conflict. You know, and how much compassion they show, how much kindness, you know, just the most ordinary kind of kindness. I remember ordinary little things that Katagiri would do, and just the way he greeted me and was with me in with sympathy in my sadness and in my struggles, and also was extremely happy when I was happy. And I think of the many stories Tim has told about Suzuki Roshi and his acts of kindness, his little acts of kindness, going to play tennis with Betty. That's 40. Cleaning the kitchen at the frat house, wasn't that it? It was a frat house. Yeah. Little things that you never forget. They're so touching. And that change us at a fundamental level. So this brings joy. And I want to know, I want to ask you, who's been your model of kindness and compassion? What sorrows and losses have transformed themselves in you into the living cells of your heart? And what had to happen for you to come back to baseline yourself? Come back to a place of well-being after your sorrows and your loss. So I'm interested to hear that from you. And I can ask you again after I read one more poem. If you don't mind hearing another poem. This one's by Mary Oliver, and it's also about death. So she's very upbeat today. It's a wonderful poem called "When Death Comes." When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what's it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. When death comes. I tried to read a book recently by Chris Hedges called something like War is a Force That Gives Us
Transforms
Meaning.
Our lives or something.
Gives us meaning. Yeah. Gives us meaning. But I ended up really not being able to relate to it at the time. Sometimes I have to pick up a book months later, but so I think that in the same vein is that death gives our life meaning. And even the trees, you know, they bloom so briefly. You know, they're just, the air is so filled with so much abundance, and then within days, the blossoms are all on the ground. So get out there today and breathe it in. Enjoy. So do any of you want to share anything or answer my questions that I asked you? I could repeat those. Too personal.
Hi. So I just watched a documentary about the tornado in Joplin that happened, what was it, last year or the year before, and it was a lot like what you were saying. Flattened the whole city, hundreds of people died, cars flipped, there's no more houses, and people were just climbing out of their houses and not being, oh, woe is me, they were just saying, how can we help, how can we help? And just how that something bigger than your own. And I also went through a tornado when I was younger. My house is fine, but the city next to mine was flattened. And how that's all you're thinking about is, how can I help these people? How can I be of service and kindness? And so I really resonated when you said that.
Thanks.
Somebody
over here. Hi.
I have a friend who recently lost her home and all her belongings in a house fire. And what really struck me in the aftermath of that is over and over she kept repeating, you know, that the experience of kindness from other people following that was the most amazing thing. Like, she had never really known that this fountain of compassion existed.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't wish disasters on anybody, you know, and I think in many ways my life would have been easier if I hadn't had that experience at such a young age, you know, when I had so much to work through. Such a need for it to reestablish a sense of safety. But it's true, it's part of our experience, and that's one beautiful thing that comes out of it, that like an amazement. Becoming just briefly a bride.
I don't remember where I read this, and I'm probably not going to get the quote right, but it resonated with what you were saying. So it's something to the effect of knowing that death is a certainty, but the time of death is uncertain. Mm-hmm. What's most important in this moment?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it goes, you know, when you think about it, it's like,
at this point, I don't want to die. I just want to be clear about that. I enjoy life.
I'm sorry.
Okay, I'll go first. So I just recently, within like the last month, I got news that my voice teacher was terminally ill, and she passed away on Tuesday. But sorry, never mind. And it just, what you were saying reminded me, because about the bus, thinking they're going to go on forever, even knowing that she was going to go. You always feel like you have tomorrow. So going back to what you said.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss.
And hopefully it will awaken kindness in me and more appreciation of the moment, you know. So, not taking anything for granted. Mm-hmm. Ever again. Mm.
I just wanted to say that I really liked the fact that on the spine of that book, Saved by a Poem,
mm-hmm.
if you hold it up for a second, it says used.
Well used. Anything else?
I actually had a question for you. when you talk about when you talk about compassion, it stems from an initial understanding or reaching out to a shared experience. And when you have this understanding, the nature of the understanding brings down the barriers between individuals. However, I find that oftentimes people who begin to have this shared experience. They're able to relate. This barrier begins to come down. They also fear, perhaps, the responsibility that compassion entails when you feel for others. Mm-hmm. When you feel for the dead end again on the side of the road, the white poncho. When you feel, when you have this connection to the individual, there's a lot of shared responsibility. Yeah. And some people are unable to reconcile the responsibility of that relationship with maintaining that level of compassion or maintaining the understanding, in that they begin to fight it. They fight the compassion because they feel now they have that responsibility. It weighs on them. And I was wondering if you had, I mean, it might just be a comment, or if you have something to add to that, and how does one reconcile that responsibility where you don't overstep what you can give, you don't overstep and, you know, ruin yourself in this sudden responsibility that you carry with yourself.
Right. Well, we're all capable of responding in a crisis, you know, beyond our own comfort zones. When there's a house fire and a tornado, we have systems that course with, you know, chemicals that help us. You know, we get adrenaline. But I think what you're talking about is the need for self-compassion. You know, to include, you know, leave no one out of the circle means don't leave yourself out either. So how do you do that? You know, how do you do that? And also be open and reach out and care and feel a sense of responsibility, act on that to the best of your ability. But I think that what I was saying when I was talking about returning to baseline of well-being, we have to have that baseline of well-being in order to be able to act on compassion, right? How we can get overwhelmed, get compassion fatigue, you know, and get tired, burnt out, and that's usually a sign we need to give ourselves some care. Yeah. That answer it?
I think you did a very nice job.
Okay. Hey. Okay. Anything else before we end?
I was just going to say that hearing your talk and the comments that follow made me start connecting some things. About 4 years ago, right in a row, I had two big losses. Lost my mother, and then I lost my job, and then I lost my mother, and you see how the world changes, and then you're still alive, and you know, still able to be happy, and how kind everybody is. I mean, it was great big moments, you know, you see it, and then you quickly, you know, I get back to routine and everything, and it's easily forgot in a way. Mm-hmm. And so when you were talking about the act, you know, the random act of kindness, or you know, whatever you were saying about the Ricky machine, the little acts of kindness that you can do every day, it must be, seems to me, like an exercise, just like an artist exercises his voice, you know, or writing or whatever. Mm-hmm. To do that kind of prepares you to be present on a regular basis, you know, when there isn't
catastrophic. Yeah, yeah. Everyday kindnesses are, I think that's, it's just like practice every day. You know, we can do long retreats, but what really sustains our practice is the daily experiences. So, yeah, making a point to notice when you received a small kindness. That's practice. And and looking for ways you could extend something very small. It doesn't have to be big. Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. We contract back into our, you know, our habits. And one of the biggest challenges for me is to work on my habits, you know, just kind of wear away at those habits of mind, behavior, you know, those ruts. That's kind of like the enemy, if there is one, if how habit-bound we are, we can be. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.